Okay, so a long while ago, I had some chest pains. They took me to the hospital, ran some tests. I'm laying in one of those hospital beds, scared, surrounded by the pinkish plastic curtain, and the doctors on the other side of this thin, crinkly sheet, they start talking about me. Oh my God, I don't know. I've never seen anything like it. What do you think?
Well, I think the same thing you do. It's gotta be the bacterial meningitis.
Poor kid. He had his whole life in front of him. And then naturally, I start screaming at the top of my lungs. And now they want to sedate me because I'm agitated. Yes, I'm agitated. Your stupid doctors keep talking about me in the past tense. I'm right here. Well, I didn't have bacterial meningitis. Actually, no one had any idea what I had, but eventually, they said I was free to go. And walking out, I was angry. Righteous indignation. How dare they? Angry. Until I looked around and realized that most people in those other rooms, they weren't going anywhere for a while. Today on Snap Judgment, from WNYC, The Patient. Amazing stories from real people under the microscope. My name is Glenn Washington. Please eat your fruits and vegetables because you're listening. Listening to Snap Judgment. After that open, you might not know it, but love is in the air. That's why we're kicking off today's The Patient episode, the first date story. Mouthwash, check. Cologne, check. Lorraine Berry tells us her story.
Back in 06, before you could swipe left and right, there was the salon personals hot list.
He had dark black hair and sort of an olive complexion. Somebody had taken a picture of him when he was sitting on the floor, leaning up against his couch, and he had a cup of coffee to his mouth. He was drinking from it. And there was something about him drinking coffee that just filled me with this idea of, you know, that he looked like Sunday morning. And Sunday morning for me is kind of sexy. His name was Yves. It was spelled Y-V-E-S, traditional French spelling. We were both 42. And he also mentioned that he was looking for a mermaid. And, he had two daughters. And he was raising them to be riot girls, which was exactly what I was raising my daughters to be. It made me feel something warm toward him. I'd been online dating for about 3 years, and in that time, I had been on my share of disastrous dates, I think would be a good word for it. So when I looked at Eve's profile, and especially in those first emails we were exchanging, I kept waiting for him to reveal himself as someone who just wasn't as good as he appeared to be.
So after the hot list, Lorraine and Eve started going through the rounds of online dating. You know, from the messages to the really long messages. Then they hopped on the phone and talked way past their bedtimes, until finally, they decided to meet for the first time for a weekend date in Montreal.
I didn't have the money to pay for a hotel, and there was no way that I was going to drive 5 hours to Montreal and then turn around and drive home after a date. It just wasn't going to happen. And so he said, you know, when you get up here, you can sleep in my daughter's room. His daughter, who he shared custody with, stayed in that room from time to time. And, you know, let's just plan on, I'll be your tour guide for Montreal. I just found it so easy to talk to him when I was on the phone with him that I even confessed things like, you know, there is this secret fear that you're going to take one look at me and I'm not going to be what you want. And he just kept saying things back to me that we were going to be two friends meeting for the weekend and that was where we were going to start. So So I pull up. I park on the street across from his building. And there he was. He looks like what I'm expecting. One thing I did notice that I hadn't seen in his profile is his teeth were crooked. I noticed it, and then I didn't notice it anymore.
Eve walked over and gave her a nice warm hug. He smelled like tobacco, and she didn't mind. Then he carried her stuff to his apartment, showed Lorraine her bedroom, and offered her a drink.
And I said, okay, but just a minute, I have to check the refrigerator. I'll explain in a minute. And so I opened the fridge, and there was nothing in there, at which point I dialed my friend Angela. I said something like, well, hi, Angela. I just want to let you know I'm here in Montreal, and I'm at Eve's apartment. And I've opened the fridge, and there are no severed heads in here. So I'm going to assume that he's not an axe murderer and that I'm going to be okay this weekend. And Eve kind of laughed, and then he said, yes, Lorraine, but you didn't open the freezer. And I started laughing, and he started laughing, and, you know, this is going fantastic.
Eve excitedly shared his weekend plans with Lorraine, and that for now, he wanted to start by going grocery shopping together to make her a nice dinner.
I thought, okay, that's great, that's great. So I said, okay, I need to go into the bathroom. And I went into the bathroom and I came out and he was just standing in the middle of the living room. He reached out his hand and he grabbed my arm and he pulled me toward him and he began to kiss me. And I began to kiss him back and we just didn't stop. I said, do you think we're going too fast? And he said, yes, but I don't want to stop. Neither do I. I think it was the first time he said, I feel like I've won the lottery. How has this happened? He must have said it a half dozen times. And I knew what he was talking about. I realized that I was with a lover. Probably sometime after 4:30, my stomach began to rumble and I realized how hungry I was. And so Eve and I were walking toward the market. Eve suddenly turned to me and he said, you know what? I think we need to skip the market. My head's hurting and I'm really hungry. Let's just go to this restaurant and we'll go there. And so we turned the corner and all of a sudden Eve said, there's my daughter. I saw this attractive woman, and she was pushing a little girl in a stroller. Eve stopped, and the little girl threw herself into Eve's arms, and she said, Papa. At one point, he stood up, and he said, Lorraine, this is my ex-wife, Helen. And I said hello, and she said hello, and we said our goodbyes and we continued down the road and he turned to me and he said, oh, that has just made this day even more perfect. My daughter is everything to me. And once again, I was just like, yeah, I know how that feels. So we continued on to the restaurant and I don't even remember what the food was because all I remember is I kept staring at him and he kept staring at me and we were holding hands across the table.
After dinner, Eve and Lorraine slowly strolled back to his apartment, still hand in hand, of course.
We climbed back up into the apartment. He said, yeah, my head's really bothering me. Oh, Lorraine, I hate to do this, he said, but would it be okay if I just lay down here for a little while and maybe snoozed for a couple of hours and then we can get back to being together? I knew that headaches could be distracting, and so I said, of course. After a few minutes, Eve drifted off to sleep. Shortly thereafter, I fell asleep too. I had been asleep maybe about an hour, and then I heard this loud bang. I got up out of bed and I went into the bathroom and what I saw was frightening. In front of me, the tap was running full blast. There were Tylenol scattered all over the bathroom floor and Eve was sitting on the floor against the wall and he started to stand up and then he fell over and I shook him. And there was no response. I was scared. I had a bad feeling about what was happening.
Lorraine immediately dialed 911 and requested an ambulance. When they take him away, he's no longer just unconscious.
Now, his legs won't stop shaking, his whole body is shaking, his eyelids are fluttering.
When they get to the hospital, they start wheeling Eve away.
I was upset. I could see him. I could see him through the glass, and there was nothing I could do at that moment.
The nurses told Lorraine that she should just go back home, well, his home, and wait.
It was the strangest thing to go back into that apartment knowing that Eve was at the hospital and that there was nothing I could do. And I remember that I lay back down in the bed and I buried my head in his pillow. I kept playing the scene in the bathroom over and over and over again. I found myself feeling guilty, thinking that this was my fault. I would drift off for a few minutes of sleep. And this time the phone wakes me up and it's now almost 2:30 in the morning. And there is a woman on the other line and she says, "Hello, is this the woman who brought in Eve?" And I said, "Yes, it is. This is Lorraine." And she said, do you know of any relatives that we can contact?" And I thought, "Oh my God, I don't know who his mother and father is." And it suddenly occurred to me that I had met his ex-wife, Helen.
Lorraine grabbed Eve's cell phone and gave Helen's number to the woman on the line.
I stopped her before she could get off the phone and I said, "Is Eve dying?" And she paused and she said, "Well, I can't really answer that, but it doesn't look good." I said, "Okay." And then I said, "Thank you." And then I hung up the phone and I thought, I've just thanked her for giving me this terrible news. Why did I thank her?
Once again, Lorraine drifted asleep. Then another call wakes her up at about 7 a.m.
It was Helen and she said, "We were wondering if you could come down to the hospital." And I said, "Well, what's going on?" And she said, "Well, Eve's on a respirator and we're gathering his friends. We're going to turn the respirator off later this morning, but we would like his friends to have a chance to come in and say goodbye to him. And we were hoping that you would want to come in and do that." And I said, "Yes, of course. I'll be there as soon as I can." As I came down the hallway, I felt them all turn to look at me. I felt as if this was his family's moment and I would be an intruder. The person I was most afraid of was Eve's mother. I was scared that she was going to yell at me that I had killed her son. Even before I can get through the curtain, Helen and this other tall guy, Guy, Eve's best friend, came out to me and Helen said, "We wanted to ask you a question." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, we noticed that Eve, he apparently came into the emergency room naked. There's no clothes or anything." And I said, "Yeah, that's right. We were asleep when it happened. He was naked in the bed." And I remember that she threw her arms around me and hugged me. And she just seemed so happy about that, that he had been, you know, that we had been in bed together. I was like, "Well, this is a strange reaction." But at the same time, I was like, "Wow, yeah, he wasn't alone. He was with me. And we, you know, we had been happy." So then they took me over to the bed. Eve was in the bed, of course. And on the other side of the bed, there was this white-haired man, a dark-haired woman. They were obviously Eve's mom and dad, and they looked absolutely gutted. His father explained to me that Eve had had a massive brain bleed and that the doctors had decided not to operate on him because even if they did the surgery, he would be brain dead. All of a sudden, I burst into tears, and I kept saying, "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. There wasn't something that I could do." I'm crying, and somebody put their arms around me and said, "No, no, no, no. We are so glad that you were there. Do you realize that he's been alone in that apartment for the last 2 years, and that if you hadn't been there, he would have died alone in that apartment? We are so glad that you were there." And then his mother said this incredibly generous thing to me. She said, "Would you like to have some time alone with Eve?" "Yes, please." And they all left and went out into the hallway. I came to stand by the bed. His mouth was completely covered with scrub green, medical green plug. And his arms, there were so many different IVs and tubes running in and out of his arms. He was laying there and he was sleeping. And I kept looking at him and I was like, but his color is perfect and he's breathing. How can he be dying? What do you say in a moment like this? What words are you supposed to speak when you know it's the last time you're going to get to talk to somebody? I said, "I just want you to know that your family is here and that your daughter is going to be looked after. People are going to take care of her. She's going to be okay. I just want you to know how grateful I am to you. I feel so thankful that I got to spend this time with you. I'm going to miss you so much, the possibility for us." And then I wanted to kiss him, and everywhere I looked, there were tubes. The only thing I could see that didn't have a needle or an IV coming out of it was his hand, and I bent over and I kissed his hand. "I have to go now." And then I said, "I love you." And then I walked out into the hallway.
Lorraine thanked Eve's family and friends, and then she left the hospital. She got into her car and started the long drive home back to New York. After crossing the border, she stopped at a small diner off the side of the road. This would be her first meal since her dinner with Eve.
Sort of staring at the menu, and this waitress came over, and she was probably 20 years older than me, and she poured me a cup of coffee and some cream, and she wandered away, and I remember that I just kept sitting there, and I hadn't ordered anything, and she came back over, and I felt like I owed her an explanation. So I said to her, "Listen, I'm really sorry. I was with my lover in Montreal, and I found myself referring to Eve as my boyfriend. I'd only been in this person's physical presence a total of 7 hours before he died. What right did I have to grieve?" I looked at her face, and this look flashed across her face, and I thought, "Oh God, Lorraine, nobody cares." She said, "I'm so sorry, but the same thing happened to me." And she walked away from me. I felt so bad that I had brought that pain back to her. And she came back about maybe a minute later, and she said, "A few years ago, my husband and I were on vacation, and we were in our hotel the first night, and he had a brain aneurysm, and he died." Oh my God. She poured me some coffee, and she just said, "I know what you're going through." And she stood there for a second, and then she walked back to behind the counter because there were other people in the restaurant.
Stay strong, Lorraine, and thank you so much for sharing your story with the Snap. Lorraine Berry's nonfiction has appeared in The Guardian, Lit Hub, Talking Writing, and other places. We'll have a link to her work and website, ambersands.net on snapjudgment.org. The original sound design for Lorraine's story was by Renzel Gorio. It was produced by Davey Kim. When Snap Judgment returns, bad things happen to good people, but good people happen back. And the closer, James Judd, returns with the story you have to hear to believe. When Snap Judgment, the patient continues. Stay tuned. Back to Snap Judgment, the patient episode. Today, we're exploring what it means to turn yourself over to the system. And our next storyteller has had some issues with that authority. His story comes to Snap from the This Is Actually Happening podcast. with some close snap judgment.
I was working. I was a flow manager for Target, you know, getting paid, going to work, coming home to my family, and, you know, doing what a man's supposed to do. Just so happened, when we getting off work, because I was working graveyard from 8 at night to 8 in the morning, and that morning I was getting off work, and I'm walking out to my truck, and they was robbing the store next door to Target, where I was working at. I hear the gunshots. I'm finna run back over to this building. But me not knowing, I'm running to where they shooting, where the bullets is actually coming from. That's when I got hit. And I remember the ambulance coming, the police coming. And I remember the officer asked me what happened. I'm like, man, I'm shot. Get me to the hospital. Who shot me? I ain't did nothing to nobody. Just lay still. So I'm going ballistic. I'm trying to get home to my wife. And I'm cussing him out. So then the officer tells me, just calm down. I'm like, I'm trying to calm down. And then as I'm talking, I see it's getting dark. Everything just went black. The very last word I said to the officer, why y'all turn the lights out? It's daytime. We ain't turning out no lights. The only thing I knew was blackness. That's the only thing I saw. And I was in a whole new world. When I wake up again, I'm in the morgue. I'm laying flat out on the table, and I'm looking around. Then I feel coldness, and I look. I have no type of clothes. Only thing I have is my birthday suit on, if you know what I mean. That's all I got. I'm laying on a steel table. They got like one of them roller cart tables right next to that table with different assortments of knives, saws, and tools, and all that stuff. And they had a tag thing wrapped around my toe. And I know if they got the tag on your toe, you supposed to be dead. So I'm like, wait a minute, they thinking I'm dead? Seriously? How can I be dead? And the one that cut you open in the morgue, he standing over me, and he like this close to me, to my stomach, to getting ready to cut me open. So I raise up. I'm like, who are you? What are you doing? Where am I at? And he took off running. So I get up, walk up out the morgue, and I'm walking to the hospital butt naked. Everybody looking at me crazy. I'm like, why y'all looking at me crazy? What am I doing? Where am I at? What am I doing here? Next I hear, we have a dead man walking around the hospital. We have a dead man walking around the hospital with no clothes on. So I'm like, what a dead man there? So I'm tripping now. I'm ready to run. Everybody's scared. I mean, wouldn't nobody come close to me in that hospital? It's like they frozen in time. They just stuck. But they staring at me. As I know, I got all these security guards grabbing me. He's standing me, trying to put me back on a gurney. You're dead. What are you doing? I'm like, if I'm dead, how can I be talking to you? Say, you was brought here in a body bag. You was in the morgue. Your family already know. Y'all told my family I was dead. Your family was there when they pronounced you dead. I'm like, okay, but I'm not dead. So can I go home? I heard one nurse say, I ain't never in my life seen somebody be down in the morgue for 4.5 hours. And all of a sudden, they come walking up out the morgue. I ain't never seen that happen. I mean, they just looked at me like, I'm not there, you know, like you're watching a scary movie. But I don't know, they looking at me this way. I'm looking at them crazy, trying to figure out, why am I here? Can we get you to just stay in this room so a doctor can come and check you out? I'm like, okay. I said, y'all was trying to kill me. He said, no, they was finna cut you open. That's why you got that scar on your stomach. I'm like, scar? So I look, and it was a scar there. So I'm like, can I go home now? He said, yeah, can we just call somebody to come and get you? Because we don't want you driving. Matter of fact, I don't stay too far, I can walk. He said, no, sir. We don't want you doing that. I'm like, my vital signs seem to be very good to me. My heart beating. I'm talking. I'm walking. So I'm alive. I'm gone. I'm finna get up out of here. When I walked out the door, then I arms, hands from every direction grabbing me. Tell me, you can't leave, you can't leave. You have to see a doctor. I ain't see a doctor for what? Doctor just tried to kill me. What am I see a doctor for? I'm going home. He said, well, are you able to walk? I said, I was doing good till y'all grabbed me. He said, we can't force you to do nothing. I said, good, get your hands off me. I walked out the hospital. So I'm walking down the street. I'm walking down the street butt naked. Got almost to the house, and two police stopped me and asked me, why was I walking down the street naked with no clothes on? I said, because I just got the hospital, they tried to kill me. They actually started laughing. They said, a hospital trying to kill you? I said, yeah. Why would they try to kill you? I said, I don't know. I know I got shot, and I was taken to the hospital. And when I woke up, this guy got a saw thing trying to cut me open. So now can I go home? He said, yeah, but you don't have nothing to put on? I'm like, no. He said, well, we got some extra shirts. Man, I'm not putting on no police shirt, and you're not going to give me no ride. I said, I'll stay a couple houses down. I said, okay, well, we're going to follow you, make sure you make it home so you don't get harassed by another officer. I said, okay, thank you, but now bye, I'm gone. When I get home, I knock on the door. My daughter opened the door, and my daughter, just as soon as she saw me, she passed out. And then when she hit the floor, I'm trying to rush and catch her. So at this time, my wife coming around the corner out the kitchen, coming to the front door, because we never allowed our daughter to open the door before. When my wife coming, I'm bent down over my daughter, trying to pick my daughter up and put her on the couch. And when I raise up, my wife see my face, and she just stuck. She's like, no, 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 that, no. She come grab me and start twisting my skin, trying to see what she dreaming. I'm like, ouch, that hurt. She fainted. I'm like, oh, hell no. What does it take? So I did her pick up, put her on the other couch. So I go in the room, get me some clothes, go in and take me a shower, get dressed, then I come back out. Both of them be sitting up now, staring towards the bathroom. Okay, what happened? I say, you tell me. She say, they pronounce you dead right there on the scene. You got shot 5 times. They wasn't shooting at you. You happened to walk out and got caught in a crossfire. After you got shot, you still trying to run for cover, but you didn't make it. I'm like, what are you talking about? How can I get shot 5 times? I remember getting hit once. Baby, the police and then the people who saw, who eyewitnessed, they gave us the whole information. Your stomach looked like you was 9 months pregnant, like you was gonna have a big baby. I'm like, okay, for real. So she said, yeah. Contacted all the family. So when it's time for the funeral, everybody be there. But now you here. Now we gotta change all this around. I said, well, you better hurry up and do that because I am not dead. And I never want to go to the hospital again because they tried to kill me. See, they didn't try to kill you, baby. Listen to me. I'm not going to lie to you. They did not try to kill you. Okay, so I got down on my knees and I kissed the ground and started praying, thank you, God. Because apparently it wasn't my time.
Big love and good health to everyone involved. That piece was adapted from Whit Misseldine's podcast, This Is Actually Happening, which features stories about what happens when everything changes. You listen on their website or subscribe to their podcast on iTunes. I suggest you do that. Now, when Snap continues, James Judd returns to answer the question, how far is too far? Do not miss a moment. When the patient episode continues, stay tuned. From WNYC and NPR, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the patient episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and through the magic of modern media technology, we are transporting you now, dear listener, to Snap Judgment Live. Sensitive listeners are advised. This story does contain explicit language. Please put your hands together for the closer himself, James Judd.
So the first thing that happens when you arrive at Attica Correctional Facility in upstate New York is they give you a piece of paper where you fill out your name and the name of the prisoner that you've come to visit. And then they have, you have to explain, you know, why you're there. And there are boxes to check, like friend, family, attorney. And I think, I don't know. I'm not exactly sure who I am in this situation. And there's one more box that says other, I think, perfect. But then there are three lines with the word explain. I don't know how I'm going to explain this in three lines. What pertinent facts can I pull out of this that's going to make sense? It begins in 1998. I'm about to graduate from law school in New Hampshire. And I'm thinking about all the great things that are going to happen in my life and my bright future. I'm planning on being a country criminal defense attorney. And I'm going to have my office in a barn that I've renovated myself. And I share it with a pack of beagles that I've rescued from laboratories. And maybe there'll be two terribly clever goats. Come, Cooper. Come, Anderson. Oh, you're adorable. Just think Matlock, only gayer. At the same time, I am beginning to obsess over this unfortunate tattoo that I had put on me during a very sort of dark, destructive period in my life. And I wish I'd had the sense to get something, you know, awesome, like a naked lady fighting a dragon, or Cher. But it's just this lame-looking flower, and I hate it. It doesn't fit the new, upscale, soon-to-be-socially-respectable me, and I have to get rid of it. Well, laser surgery to remove tattoos was sort of a new thing in 1998, and I find an ad in the back of a magazine for a place in New York City called the Skin Ovations Clinic, and it specializes in tattoo removal with laser surgery. I call, I take a bus to Boston, I take a train to New York, I take a cab to the Upper East Side, I arrive at the appointed time at the beautiful building on 73rd in Lexington. It's an Art Deco building, and I noticed on the little register of names right inside the door that Dr. Ruth works there, so, you know, classy. Even the elevator is fancy. There's vintage mirrors and a bench in case you need a cushy ride up to the 9th floor. And the big mahogany doors have brass letters that spell out the words Skin Ovations. And when I go inside, it's just beautifully decorated with mid-century modern furniture, which in my mind says, we cater to the gays. I like it. A pretty French receptionist offers me eau de glace. Gracias. And then she escorts me into an examining room that's just like any doctor's office. It's all white. It smells like rubbing alcohol. It's got, you know, jars of cotton balls, little metal trays with green towels and pointy things sticking out of them, an examination table. But there in the corner is this big white contraption that I know must be the laser machine, because I've never seen anything look like it, and it just looks terrifying. It looks like it's ready to eat me. I feel nauseous just looking at it, so I decide I just won't. I'm not going to look at it. Is it still there? I don't know. I don't see it. I remind myself that I am only here for a consultation. At this point, I am not getting involved anymore in anything beyond just talk. And then out of all the laser tattoo removal clinics, in all the dermatology offices and all of the Upper East Side, he has to walk into this one. His name is Dean Fiello, and he looks like a doctor on a soap opera. Who knew you could get a medical degree from Chippendales? Swoopy hair, puppy dog eyes, his square jaw covered in thick stubble. I feel like I've just discovered a lost Baldwin. His white lab coat traces the outline of his broad shoulders, his brawny arms, He's got a red tie over a pinstriped shirt that melts over his pecs and disappears into a pair of tight black doctor pants. He says something. Something about how different colored lasers break up different colors of ink and yada yada, I don't know. It's so hard to concentrate because he's just so handsome. Did I mention that? You're my last appointment of the day. I was about to close up, but if you'd like to stay and get started right now, I'd be happy to stay. Right now? Yes! That would be great! Absolutely! Yeah, let's do it right now! Great, I'm going to step out of the office. There's something I need to take care of. But as soon as I come back, we'll begin. You can make yourself comfortable on the examination table. The instant he is out of the room, I reach for my belt buckle, I start to drop my pants, and then I remember. The tattoo is on my arm. He comes back in a moment later with a hypodermic needle. He's got a little spring in his step. I think, ooh, great, he's into it. I like that. I'm going to give you some injections of lidocaine to numb the area, but even then, there will be some pain. And tomorrow, and for the next few days, you will be pretty sore. Well, anything good's gotta hurt a little bit, right? Lay down here. So I lay down, he gives me about 10 injections of lidocaine, and then he gets a pair of goggles, and he hands me a pair of goggles, and he fires up the laser machine, he gets to work. And it hurts. It really, really hurts. I can smell my skin burning. Do you know what burning skin smells like? Love! His face is so close to mine that I can feel his breath on my neck, and it's making me hard. Listen, I don't care if you're straight. If Superman is breathing on your neck, you're gonna get a boner. True fact. After about an hour, he pulls off his goggles. Every hair falls perfectly back into place. And he wraps my arm up in bandages. He says, the red and the black ink will begin to fade immediately. However, the green ink is going to take some time. How much time? I would say 9 treatments once every 4 months. That's 3 years. 3 years of incredible, intense pain. Okay. I wake up that night, and I'm in a fever, and my arm is on fire, and my stomach is cramping, and I lay there in bed shivering and wondering how he likes to celebrate his birthday, and what kind of car does he drive, and does he like dogs, and what would we look like in matching windbreakers? I don't know why I'm having this crazy schoolboy crush. I'm a grown man. I've been in a long-term adult relationship with all the love and the hatred and the passion, the boredom that comes along with it. And I don't have time for this distraction, but I cannot get him out of my head. I see him every 4 months religiously. And I do everything, every time I see him, to try to move the ball forward. I tell him little jokes, I tell my stories, I try to get personal information out of him. Nothing. The guy is all business. And I think, well, you know, maybe he's just a shy, retiring medical nerd who doesn't know how handsome he is. It just makes him more attractive to me. But what really makes me crazy is that I just don't understand how someone this good looking cannot want to talk about himself. I mean, if I look like that, I'd never shut up about me. I mean, of course, what am I saying? I'm a mess. I can't shut up about me now. Well, jump ahead. September 24th, 2001, 13 days after 9/11. I'm in New York. I don't live in New York, but Mayor Giuliani asked people to come back to New York, so I'm here. And I've been, right? Well, so I came. And I've been invited by a friend to be his guest at this benefit concert on Broadway of the musical Dreamgirls. And the place is just packed full of famous people. So as soon as the lights come up for intermission, I'm wandering around the lobby looking at the famous people. There's Rosie O'Donnell talking to Luther Vandross. And over here is Scott Wolf from Party of Five. Who knew he was a Dreamgirls fan? There's Chris Maloney. There's Betty Buckley and Patti LuPone are like knocking back vodka shots at the bar. And I see Dean. This is the first time I've ever seen him outside the office. Hey, Dean, how are you? I'm so glad to see you. I'm glad you're safe. It's just you know, there's no words, but I'm glad to see you. Are you enjoying the show? Dean does not react. He doesn't even seem like he can see me, even though I'm standing right in front of him. And he's pale, and his eyes are like black coals, and he's sweating. And I get it. He's high on some kind of drug, but I have no idea what kind of drug makes a person look like this. Are you all right? Do you need me to get some kind of help? The intermission over bell rings and the swirl of people around us picks up speed, and Dean just sort of turns and drifts off. I can't even concentrate on Effie and the dreams because I'm so disillusioned, not just because this object of my affection is, you know, taking some really heavy drugs, but just that I pride myself on being a person who can read people. And this time I was just so wrong. So the next day I leave a message on the answering machine canceling my appointment, and I never go back again. Jump ahead. It is February 2004. I am in Los Angeles. I have a soy latte, and I have a little table outside on the sidewalk in Santa Monica Boulevard. And I sit down, and I notice that somebody has left behind a copy of the New York Post. It's very unusual to see a New York Post in L.A. So I flip it over, and there on the cover is a picture of Dean Fiello under the headlines, "Cops Hunt for Killer Quack." Turns out he's not a doctor. He's a construction worker with no medical training whatsoever. That's not the big news. He's already been busted for stealing prescription pads and supplying his own synthetic morphine habit, this drug called Stadol, which apparently you could give like a pregnant lady one squirt and poof, they pop out a baby, right? He's apparently going through a bottle a day. That's not the big news. The police have found the body of one of his patients, stuffed in a suitcase, buried under the cement floor of his garage in New Jersey. Her name was Maria Cruz. She was a 35-year-old investment analyst for Barclays. She went missing on April 13th, 2003, and the last notation in her day planner was a Sunday early evening appointment with Dean Fiello. Meanwhile, Dean is missing. He is nowhere to be found. Also, according to the Post, which is all over this story, he has been rumored to have been seen in San Jose, Costa Rica, working as a naked go-go boy in a gay disco. I read this, I think. This is horrible. And then I think, well, how much does it cost to go to Costa Rica? The story is all over the tabloids. Everybody covers it. The New York Times, the Daily News, the Post, People Magazine does a whole story on it. 48 Hours Mystery does an entire hour. Even Vanity Fair publishes an 8-page expose on his playboy life before he became a fugitive. Far from being a retiring medical nerd, he is a notorious Lothario who has left a string of broken hearts across Manhattan. Well, by this time, I think I don't have any more capacity to be shocked by any of this. Until I come across this line. The handsome playboy had a well-known reputation for partying with his patients! You fucker!
Jacuzzi.
Dean Fiello was eventually captured at a pool bar at a resort in San Manuel Antonio El Capitan, Costa Rica. He spends 15 months in a Costa Rican prison. They bring him back to the U.S. in chains, and then he spends 19 months in Rikers Island. And then he accepts a plea deal, which sends him to Attica for 20 years. That, I think, is the end of that. But there's more. Jump ahead. January 2012. You know, right now, I don't know whether I should finish my story or sing Over the Rainbow. I don't know what I'm gonna... Do we have clearance? No clearance? No, we can't get clearance for that? All right. January 2012. I am living in San Francisco. I'm married to a guy named Eric. We have a couple of dogs. We have a house. We have a business together, and life is great. I know that's a lot of time compression, but this is radio, and the clock's a ticking. And frankly, aren't we all just really jonesing for a drink about now? The band's got to play their last set at the subway at 53rd and Lexington. They need their getting home money. Yeah. Anyway, there is a new story on the news about a fake doctor. And this time, everyone in the news media, and by everyone I mean Nancy Grace, is blaming the victims. Oh, how could they not know? How could they not know they were a victim of a fake doctor? Blah, 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 blah. And I start to think, well, maybe I ought to tell my story about how I was the victim of a fake doctor. And then I start to think, I wonder what Dean Fiello would say about what he did if I had a chance to ask him. So I write to him. And I don't really think that he's going to write back, but I figure if he does, or even if he doesn't, it'll make a nice little wrap-up to my anecdote about the time I had a brief 3-year obsession with someone who turned out to be a famous killer. But he does write back. He writes page after page after page of grief and remorse and shame and humiliation. 20 pages in all handwritten on line notepads, note paper. And behind it is a 12-page story he has written about the day that woman died in his office. And this is from the end of that story. I caught a glimpse of myself in the wall mirror. Puffy, sleep-deprived eyes stared back at me. I took another hit of coke. I couldn't get through a single day without medicating myself. Cocaine for energy, morphine for the long hours spent hunched over patients, tense, sweaty, laser in hand, Ativan to level it all out. As soon as I walked back in the treatment rooms, I knew something was wrong. White foam filled the interior of her mouth. Panic seized me like a bear's claw. I shoved the laser away from the table, smashed it into the wall. I checked for a pulse. I felt nothing. I started CPR, still nothing, and I knew she was gone. My day of reckoning had arrived. So I write him back. I say, send me another story. And then they start coming, you know, 1, 2, sometimes 3 a month. And I like it. I like having a prison pen pal. There's something very Jane Austen-y about getting a handwritten letter in 2012. It's sort of like, you know, Mr. Darcy goes to solitary. Poor Lydia is buried in the garage. Ooh, what will happen next? And so after about a year of writing to each other, I decide to go see him. At the visitor center, I check friend, and I immediately feel weird about it. And a guard escorts me to the visitor's room. He gives me a table. He tells me where to sit and wait for my prisoner to arrive. And The visitor's room looks nothing like I expected to. On one wall, there are giant murals of orcas swimming through the ocean. And over here on the ceiling, there are eagles flying free. And there's a bank of vending machines filled with stuff that the prisoners can't get in the commissary. And prison wives scooping out armloads of sodas and chips and salad and sandwiches. And there are people playing games. There's some kids running around. There's a charismatic minister making the rounds, shaking hands, cracking jokes. But it's relaxed, you know, it's calm. It's just like an ordinary day. And then out of all the visitors' rooms and all the maximum security prisons in all of America, he walks into this one. Dean Fiello. But he's changed. Much smaller, thinner, gray hair, glasses. He approaches the table, we shake hands, and there's a moment where we look at each other, really look at each other for the first time with our eyes open and our minds clear. His free of drugs and not hiding behind a fake persona, and me not feeling like I need to entertain him every minute just to get his attention. But also behind those eyes, I realize that he doesn't remember me. So I say, now that I'm here, do you remember me? He says, no. So I roll up my sleeve and I show him my tattoo. He says, oh yeah, the green was really hard to get out. There's a couple of minutes of chit-chat and then I just start firing questions away. What made you think you could get away with this? Who helped you get the drugs? When did you start using them on yourself? Why morphine? Where were you when you knew that the police were looking for you? Why did you go to Costa Rica? Why didn't you go to Rio or Brazil where you could have blended in easier? Did you know there was a story about you in Vanity Fair? Where were you when you caught? How did you survive in the prison in Costa Rica if you didn't speak Spanish? And I wish I could tell you all of the things that he said to me, but I can't. I don't have time except to say that I used every weapon in my arsenal to figure out whether or not he was lying to me, and I don't believe that he was. If I had believed he was lying to me, I would have ended it there. But I think he was telling me the truth. So I said, I want to talk about the day that woman died in your office, because the way you wrote about it in your story, I don't think it happened that way. Because I did some research online on death by lidocaine, and it doesn't happen the way you wrote it, quick. In fact, it takes a really, really long time for someone to die of an overdose of lidocaine, long enough that you had time to call someone for help. I called a friend who was a doctor. And what did he tell you to do? He told me to hang up and call 911. And what did you do? I hung up. But you didn't call 911. And the medical examiner said that you had. That woman probably would have lived, so why? Why didn't you call 911 when you had a chance to save that woman's life? I don't know. I don't know. The most honest answer I can give you is, I don't know. I don't know why I didn't do it. Panic, fear, shame, I wish I had. I ask myself that question every day. A bell rang and people got up and started getting ready to leave. So I stood up and I reached out my hand to shake his and he reached over and embraced me and it was awkward. And when I broke free, I said, listen, I went through your case file and I found something that might get you out of here a little bit early. It's not a reduction in sentence. It's just that the time you spent in jail in Costa Rica should have been applied to your sentence here. It's a technicality. I'll follow up on that. So, anyway, he said, James, before you go, I want to tell you something. You asked me earlier if I'd had many visitors, and the fact is I haven't had any. You're the first person who's been here to visit me in the 8 years since I arrived at Attica, so thank you for that. Oh. Well, I'm glad I came. As soon as I get to the parking lot, I'm completely disoriented to be out in the light, and I'm wandering around trying to find my rental car, and a guard, the one who showed me where to sit in the visitor room, passes me and he says, you get what you came for? Yes. No, maybe, I don't know. Is the obsession over with? I think so, but I'm still talking about it. I mean, here I am, right? And we're still writing to each other almost every month. I can't forgive him for what he did to Maria Cruz or any of the other people that he conned. That's not my place. But I do forgive him for what he did to me. and I do consider him to be my friend. And I still have half a tattoo. And I'm keeping it.
James Judd, ladies and gentlemen. The original score for that piece was by Alex Mandel, performed by Alex and the Snap Players, Tim Frick, and David Brandt. You can see and feel and share this performance in vivid Technicolor glory. Simply go to our website, snapjudgment.org, watch the video of this performance right now. Trust me, you've got to see it. You've been listening to Snap Judgment, the patient episode, and it is about that time. But don't worry, because there are hours of Snap storytelling awaiting your pleasure right now. Subscribe to the amazing storytelling podcast, I'll Be Your New Best Friend, snapjudgment.org. On the Facebook, on the Twitter, Snap is produced by the team that never takes a sick day. Bring something from the cafeteria for the Uber producer, Mark Ristich, Pat Lucidi Miller, Anna Sussman, Davey Kim, Nancy Lopez, Joe Rosenberg, Renzo Gorio, Anna Allerstein, Eliza Smith, Leon Morimoto, Matt Ducott, Jasmine Aguilera always washes her hands. The CPB knows what to do with those paper things that go over the toilet seat. Much love to them. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could be shot in an aborted robbery, left for dead, wake up in the morgue, and then walk home butt naked, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.